Welcome to this 13th edition of the Becoming Human in the Cosmos podcast, based on the book of the same title on Amazon. This podcast will center on the 6th chapter, titled Hell and Evil, Part 2. Let's consider some of the traditional evils in terms of development of the soul and see why they are evil. First, murder. That brings to a screeching halt the progress of someone else's soul, at least as far as the mortal experience goes. That soul can continue to develop in the spirit realms, but there are unique experiences here that can't be had elsewhere. For example, nowhere else in the cosmos do we have to deal with poverty, illness, handicaps, warfare, or the perfidy of other humans. These, though a damn nuisance at times, are nonetheless things that most quickly and strongly develop our souls. More on this in a later chapter. As to the development of the soul of the murderer, he has demonstrated an anti-life bent and is totally out of sync with the direction of the cosmos, as previously discussed. It's like trying to go on to college while deliberately throwing away the knowledge one has obtained in elementary school. The evil of adultery. The cosmos consists of a family relationship at the top, a father and mother god having children. Adultery is anti-family. It destroys the love and trust needed between a man and a woman to form the basis of a stable home. One of our greatest and hardest tasks here is to form a loving, functioning bond with a member of the opposite sex, have children together, and put in place a home similar to the heavenly home from which we came. And looking at our current divorce rate, it's obviously not an easy assignment. Plus, even with families that do stay together, how many of them are stable, nurturing, and nourishing environments for the growth of children? No one said it would be easy. Adultery is a big roadblock in the development of these close spousal relationships, and there is, therefore, a big roadblock in the mutual development of the two souls so involved, not to mention their children. The evil of homosexuality, or same-sex attraction. This is in the same ballpark as adultery, as far as I'm concerned. The cosmos being based on a heterosexual relationship and the expansion of human life, the homosexual relationship contributes nothing to this. Do I believe homosexuals will find themselves in a burning hell? No, I do not. But they may find themselves on the outside looking in. The souls of their contemporaries on Earth will be putting together their eternal families and beginning to expand and populate their portions of the cosmos from experiences garnered in a heterosexual relationship on Earth. Homosexuals will have no such background from which to draw the resources needed. Historian Will Durant, The Pleasures of Philosophy, writes wisely on the heterosexual relationship. Quote, "It is time that makes at last the complete marriage of two souls. For in those years of parentage, how many trials must come, and how many vicissitudes of fortune, how many tortures of the body and terrors of the heart. Sickness brings to the fickle fancy a certain depth and soberness, and love takes on new life in the imminence of death. Plans made and tried together, victories won hand in hand, and desolation shared mortis congenial minds into a spiritual partnership that almost rises to a merger of personalities. Even the two faces may become alike. To watch together over the cradles of children, to see them grow, and to give them at last, reluctantly, to some younger love, is to be made one. When the home that has echoed with the laughter of children is haunted with their still memory, love, as if in consolation, brings all its wealth again to the comrades of many years. Its great gamut is not full till it has soothed with its warmest presence the loneliness of age and the nearness of the great enemy." Those who knew it as desire knew only the root and flesh of it. The soul of it remains now, with every physical element burned away. In this remating of old hearts, the spiritual flowering of the body's hunger is complete. Page 113. Gays simply won't have the established relationships and experiences to continue to completion the establishment of an eternal family. The development of their souls to the ultimate potential comes to a halt. And maybe they don't mind. Maybe as long as they have the same-sex partner of their choice and are happy together, it's no big deal for them. As I said earlier, not everyone wants to be a CEO in this family business. Each soul must seek that which will be a satisfactory level of eternal happiness for them. And it's none of our business where others settle. But I feel we need to go forward with knowledge of the consequences of our choices and actions. Those who choose not to resist the temptation of same-sex attraction effectively bring to a halt the ultimate development of their souls. If you're going to go there, at least go there knowingly. The evil of pornography. We are created in the image and likeness of God. Pornography turns that image into that of a rutting animal. It almost always exploits the more vulnerable of our species, females to be sure, sometimes at its worst, children and animals. I take it quite literally, and I think God does too, that those who would harm one of his little ones would be better off had they tied a millstone around their neck and jumped into the sea. Mark chapter 9, verse 42. But to just view this satanic dreck is bad enough. There's no way we can stand before God, having gotten thrills and entertainment from watching our brothers and sisters turn the image of God into that of animals and heat, humiliating and disgracing themselves for drug money, and think it's okay with God that he'll marvel at the development and maturity of our souls. Think also, these are his children that we're watching debase themselves. If you had a daughter who was making porn flicks, and a neighbor reported to you how he had seen her performing certain acts, and what a great little whore she was, would you feel kindly towards that neighbor? It is said that if you eat junk food, you get a junk body, decaying teeth, overweight, clogged arteries, diabetes, etc. It's the same with junk entertainment. Our minds and spirits need nourishment just as our bodies do. What we put into them will make them into those images. You eat junk food, you get a junk body. You consume junk entertainment, you get a junk mind, a junk spirit. It behooves all of us to be sure we're putting wholesome foods into our minds and hearts. Our spiritual health depends on this, not to mention our eternal development. The last three evils had to do with sexual conduct. No one need think I'm a prude. I've fathered four children and had a close, loving, intimate physical relationship with my wife. The point is, God has temporarily given us one of his greatest gifts, the gift of procreation, or creating life, indeed, in his own image. To put it accurately, we create mortal vessels for his spirit-child life that he sends to them, but among other purposes, it's still a test to see what we do with the life-creating gift, and what we do with that gift or talent will be called to account as we stand before him for that inevitable life review. Remember in the parable of the talents that the talent is taken away from him who misused it and given to one who used his correctly. Matthew chapter 25, verses 14 through 30. Imagine giving your 10-year-old a $15,000 Rolex watch for Christmas. A few minutes later, you hear a banging out in the garage and go out to see what he's doing. You find him hammering at nails into a board with it. It'll be a cold day in hell before you give that kid another Rolex. Same with God and the precious gifts he gives to us. If we don't appreciate them and use them properly for our own development and the development of others, they'll be taken away from us. You love sex? Sure. It's fun. It feels good. It creates a special bond between lovers that can't be had by any other means. It's temporary unless you prove worthy. Uncontrolled creation of life in the cosmos would have the same disastrous results that it has here, only on an infinitely larger order. and the results it has here? How many of our prison inmates are children who weren't wanted by their fathers, but were just the result of an uncontrolled moment? The wise heads of the cosmos won't let us criminalize their environs as we do our current realms. The evil of theft. Since theft is based on material greed for the most part, the thief is again out of sync with the cosmos. In the cosmos, all have the material goods they need, without price or labor. Thievery contributes but little to the development loss of the soul of the victim, unless the victim dwells on it and obsesses over revenge and anger. But the thief has demonstrated a willingness to not work and earn his own way, and to victimize his brother or sister. The cosmos is based on relations of trust. God only trusts those to open their branch offices who have proven trustworthy. You can't trust a thief. It's not so much that we'll have stuff in the eternities that can be stolen and we'll need to guard. It's that we'll not want to work with someone who didn't want to work honestly and constructively in mortality. The thief will be greatly limited in his options in the cosmos, and we must all remember the entire cosmos knows our character. There are no secrets. A person who has gotten away with thievery all their lives here will be as transparent as glass there. Their sneaking and duplicitous souls will have severe limits on where they can go and what they can do. The scriptures allude to this. He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much, and he that is unjust in the least is also unjust in much. If therefore ye have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches? Luke chapter 16, verses 10 through 11. You've shoplifted a 99-cent candy bar? The whole cosmos knows. Emanuel Swedenborg claimed that everything we've ever thought or done is a permanent part of our memories, and these memories are accessed at the Life Review. Quote, there were people who denied crimes and disgraceful things they had committed in the world, so lest people believe them innocent, all things were uncovered and reviewed out of their memory. Foremost were matters of adultery and whoredom. Their wiles and thefts were recounted one after another, many of them things hardly anyone in the world had known other than the thieves themselves. They admitted them, too, since they were made clear as daylight. There were people who took bribes and made a profit out of judicial decisions. There was one person who thought nothing of disparaging others. All these elements were set forth and presented together in wholly lifelike fashion, yet the details had been studiously covered up by him while he had lived in the world. End quote. Lundahl and Woodison previously cited, pages 258-259. The evil of lying. The cosmos is based on truth. Those who lie, especially to destroy the character of others, are trying to function in a cosmos that doesn't exist. Like the thieves mentioned above, no one will be able to trust them, and everyone will know they're lying. There is no escape from full disclosure. Imagine a liar being asked if the solar system he has overseen is ready to function for the benefit of human life. He has fudged his work, but thinks he can fob it off on an unsuspecting deity. The planet is populated, a couple billion souls. All of a sudden, the sun goes supernova and all life is obliterated without chance for their growth and development. Would God allow such malfeasance as this? Of course not. And he won't allow liars to have any serious responsibilities in the cosmos either. And with these observations, I say woe to those politicians who spin truth, or even just make it up, to fit certain politically correct paradigms, to ruin reputations, swing elections, or just to throw dirt on both sides of the coin, right and left. These are people with college and university educations who wear suits to work, who appear neat, clean, honest, well-educated, and whose lives are given to manipulating a gullible public for money. Brings to mind the description of Satan in the previous lecture, well-dressed, charming. The evils of addictions. We'll see in a later near-death vision of those who gave their lives over to drugs and alcohol here what a tragic fate state they're in, as the addictions appear to deepen beyond physical need to spiritual and mental. Addiction is almost literally a chain, and those who have gone too long in these habits will find themselves no more capable of escaping these obsessions in the eternities than they can here. Best not to start. Best to take abstinence seriously and get help if you've already begun using drugs. Further, addiction centers our lives on chemical substance as a source of joy, when the only true source of joy is a life centered on Christ. It's like a teacher trying to teach a class where every student is plugged into his MP3 player, listening to music played at full blast. The teacher can't get through. As we'll see as we go, neither can Christ. The list of sins is long, but you get the general drift. All sin of whatever form interferes with the development of the soul of the sinner, to be sure, and in many cases the soul of the person sinned against if they don't handle it properly. I believe we must conduct our lives in conformity with the eschatological outlook, as mentioned in chapter 1, and put sin into that context. Let's consider a victimless crime. Take gambling. If one has the money or the ability to stop at certain points so they don't bankrupt their family, or if they have no family so their losses are only their own and they aren't taking food out of the mouths of their children, what's the harm? Many have said that gambling is evil because we're trying to get something for nothing. That, to me, is a minor flaw, if at all. Our whole lives are something for nothing. When have we ever sent God a payment for our life? And what of investing in the stock market? Isn't that a form of gambling, of trying to get something for nothing? I think the problem with gambling is that we are hoping, tacitly and subconsciously at least, for the failure and misfortune of our brothers and sisters. We can't win unless they lose. And it is this element of dark feelings towards our brothers and sisters that is harmful, the jealousy, the coveting. When you're pulling the lever on a slot machine, you may not be deliberately hoping for evil luck to befall the person next to you, but that's what has to happen for you to win. If you go out of the casino with $1,000, it's not the casino's money. It's the money of all those going out with you with sour looks on their faces. And imagine yourself going out of the casino with $1,000 less than what you came in. Going out with you is a typical trailer trash female, thick makeup, belly flab hanging out over her lowrider, bright lime green polyester, too tight pants, hair colored outrageous pink, and piled up in some kind of ungodly beehive, and she's dancing around gloating, "I won, I won." Are the thoughts in your heart, "Congratulations, I'm so happy for you," or are they a bit darker? I'm betting, maybe that's the wrong word, that the set of your heart at that daughter and your sister, that the set of your heart at that moment would be uncharitable at least, certainly unacceptable before God, whose daughter and your sister the trailer trash female is. And with that attitude in our heart, can we truly say our soul is developed, that we are ready to live like God and with God in heaven? By the way, as to the stock market, so I don't leave any loose ends from above, with investing, though one is in a real sense gambling and trying to get something for nothing or minimal investment, at least we're hoping for the success and not the failure of our brothers and sisters. If the business in which one has invested does well, then one does well too. That is, as far as I'm concerned, a higher level of heart set than pure gambling, where you tacitly must hope for the failure of your fellows. Much of God's concern for our development is the set of our heart. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Matthew 6:21. With gambling, you hope for evil to befall others. With investing, you're hoping for at least temporal good. The latter is more in line with the desires of God for us, and it brings us closer to oneness with Him. So much for sin and evil. Let's look now at the consequences. Some think God will change them from evil to good when they die. That's not the impression I get. LDS Apostle Melvin Ballard says, quote, "Do not let any of us imagine that we can go down to the grave not having overcome the corruptions of the flesh and then lose in the grave all our sins and evil tendencies. They will be with us. They will be with the spirit when separated from the body. It is my judgment that any man or woman can do more to conform to the laws of God in 1 year in this life than they could do in 10 years when they are dead. The spirit can only repent and change, and then the battle has to go forward with the flesh afterward. It is much easier to overcome and serve the Lord when both flesh and spirit are combined in one. Every man and woman who is putting off until the next life the task of correcting and overcoming the weakness of the flesh are sentencing themselves to years of bondage." End quote. Crowther previously cited page 39. That bondage is served in a place called spirit prison. The first and most impressive description of spirit prison I ever read was from George Ritchie's Return from Tomorrow, previously cited. The overriding message is that we make our own hell, and I think this is true. Remembering that controlling or coercion is the antithesis of agency and is the, quote, original, unquote, sin, as we've discussed earlier. Let's take a look at Ritchie's observations of these spirits in a prison of their own making. Quote, "In one room, a gray-haired man was sitting in an armchair dictating a letter. Standing beside him, not an inch away, another man, maybe 10 years older, kept snatching repeatedly at the speaking tube as though he would tear it from the seated man's hand. The helpless snatcher tries to countermand the orders of the seated mortal man. Apparently he had left his company to the other. On and on he went, correcting, giving orders, while the man in the chair appeared neither to see nor hear him. In another scenario, quote, I watched one woman of maybe 50 following a man of about the same age down the street. She seemed very much alive, agitated, and tearful, except the man to whom she was addressing her emphatic words was oblivious to her existence. Quote, you're not getting enough sleep. Marjorie makes too many demands on you. You know you've never been strong. Why aren't you wearing a scarf? I gathered that she was his mother. In spite of the fact that they appeared so nearly the same age, how long had she been following him this way? Was this what death was like? To be permanently invisible to the living, yet permanently wrapped up in their affairs? Pages 56 through 57. Though not hell, this is the fate, apparently, of those whose hearts are set on controlling the lives of others. They are chained to this futility until they somehow take a long look at the nowhereness of their lives and begin to search for some way out, that being turning to Christ. We'll see the results of other sins in a moment, starting with suicide, but I think it's interesting that the first spirit prison inmates Ritchie sees are the control freaks, those who tried to force their ways on the lives of others. I consider this as more evidence for my contention that the interference with agency is one of the prime concerns of deity and it can be considered the original sin, at least as far as chronology goes, and is a sin of serious consequences, as we see above. Dr. Raymond Moody, Life After Life, previously cited, pages 143 through 144, gives us some insights into suicides. Instead of a place of happiness and peace, those who commit suicide generally wind up in a worse state than that which they left. Quote, others who experienced this unpleasant limbo state have remarked that they had the feeling that they would be there for a long time. This was their penalty for breaking the rules by trying to release themselves prematurely from what was, in effect, an assignment to fulfill a certain purpose in life. One reported, While I was over there, I got the feeling that two things it was completely forbidden for me to do would be to kill myself or to kill another person. If I were to commit suicide, it would be throwing God's gift back in his face. Most heart-rending of all to me are these descriptions of suicides, back to Ritchie's book. In one house, a younger man followed an older one from room to room. "I'm sorry, Pa," he kept saying. "I didn't know what it would do to Mama. I didn't understand." But though I could hear him clearly, it was obvious that the man he was speaking to could not. "I'm sorry, Pa," the young man said again. "I'm sorry, Mama," endlessly, over and over, to ears that could not hear. Several times we paused before similar scenes, a boy trailing a teenaged girl through the corridors of a school. "I'm sorry, Nancy." A middle-aged woman begging a gray-haired man to forgive her. "What are they sorry for, Jesus?" I pleaded. "Why do they keep talking to people who can't hear them?" Then from the light beside me came the thought, they are suicides, chained to every consequence of their act. Pages 58 through 59. I personally think this doesn't cover all suicides. The Japanese suicide pilots of World War II gave their lives for a cause they deemed greater than themselves, though wrong from my American point of view. But nonetheless, they didn't throw their lives away over petty annoyances. Others commit suicide in the face of inevitable death, such as Dr. Kevorkian's patients. I'm not going to judge them. One far greater and wiser than I will consider each on a case-by-case basis. As to the suicide bombers who throw their lives away just to destroy other lives and create terror, again, a greater judge will have the final say. But I can't help but think they're in for a nasty surprise when they pass through to the other side. It has been said by some who reject the divinity of Christ that he committed suicide. He could have, after all, called down a legion of angels and avoided crucifixion. I don't think that's the best way to see that. Consider soldiers in a foxhole during a battle. An enemy grenade lands in their midst, and one of them smothers it with his body. The explosion kills him, but saves the lives of his buddies in that foxhole. Did he commit suicide? Technically, yes, but he did it to save the lives of others. Same with Christ. We should no more quibble over Christ's actions than the soldiers. As previously recorded, God sorrows deeply at suicide and takes it as a highly personal affront to his gifts of life and agency to us. Joyce H. Brown's book, previously cited, echoes Ritchie's observations. In her near-death experience, she visits a funeral. Two little girls are there with their grandmother. One girl, about four, is sitting on her grandmother's lap. The other sat close by. Neither could stop crying. But their grandmother, in such pain herself that she hardly seemed to realize they were there, was unable to offer comfort. How could she ever love them enough to ease the pain of losing a mother who had left them by choice? Their mother had taken her own life by her own actions, voluntarily giving up her chance to accomplish anything more during her life. Suddenly I saw the spirit of the young woman kneeling at her mother's feet. She was sorry. Oh, so sorry for what she had done to them. She ached for them and the pain they were experiencing because of her actions. She reached out, unable to touch them or to be felt by them. She wanted to console, to caress her children, but they didn't even know she was there. Pages 52 to 53. Can hell itself offer anything worse than this? To conclude, she was unable to communicate with or console her loved ones. She was utterly helpless to aid them in any way. I envisioned the girls beginning to grow up, raised by their grandmother. Their dead mother continued observing their progress and their pain as they grew up without her. Remember from Ritchie's observations, suicides are chained to the consequences of their action. To observe to the bitter end the results of their actions, actions which they thought would hurt no one but themselves. Her torment was great as she saw how they needed her, longed for her, hated her, and dealt with the fact of her abandonment of them, which they perceived as rejection at every stage of their lives. And not only the struggles of her children and mother is she forced to observe, but those of others affected by her suicide. Pages 54 through 55. I remember once in my life, I've never seriously contemplated suicide, but there was a time when my career life was going nowhere, when I was failing in everything I tried, that dark thoughts occasionally came to me. I was standing in the darkened hall outside of our kitchen. My wife and children were making cookies. I could hear their laughter and conversation. They didn't know I was outside the kitchen. I could smell the dough and the fresh baked cookies, but that wall was between us. The thought came to me that if I continued to let dark thoughts stay in my mind, that wall could become permanent. I'd always be an outsider to those I loved most. I went into the light, into the kitchen, and enjoyed the company of my loved ones, not to mention the cookies. I thank God I made that choice. My father taught me about dark thoughts. We're always going to have them. It's a normal part of our agency and choosing process. But as he put it, you can't stop the birds from flying over your head, but you have to stop them from building nests in your hair. One must find a means of chasing these birds off from their roosts. Singing a favorite hymn is a very good way. It's choosing an alternative to the darkness that would ultimately destroy our lives. Again, easy for me to say, I came from a loving family and had that as a married man also. Let's consider two suicide attempts by children who were not so fortunate. In Closer to the Light, previously cited, Melvin Morse and Paul Perry relate two stories of children who were so grossly abused that they tried suicide. One of the incidents is rather startling in what seems almost a callous response from the being in the light. She was only 7 when she tried to take her life. Quote, "Then I heard a voice from the light. You have made a mistake. Your life is not yours to take. You must go back." I argued with the voice. No one cares about me. The answer I got back was shocking. You're right. No one on this planet cares about you, including your parents. It is your job to care for yourself. Pages 185 through 186. Where's the warm fuzzy in this? She was taught by looking at an apple tree in winter that there were two sides to that tree. When she saw it, it appeared dead and lifeless, of no value. But in vision, she saw it in the summer, when it bore sweet and luscious fruit. Her life, like that tree in winter, was at that point seemingly dead and barren. But in time, the good fruit would come. The other suicide attempter, also a youth, relates, quote, "A spirit in the light asked me why I tried to kill myself. So I told him about how bad my life and world were. He was kind, but not very sympathetic. He said, 'Well, you'll just have to stick around and see what you can do with your life.' This young man grew to work in a summer camp for children with AIDS and sums it up, quote, 'My near-death experience taught me that I had to create my own possibilities.' Previously cited, page 188. One last look, then I'll move on. I realize this is a grim subject. I weep as I write. But suicide is a leading cause of death, especially among the young. And if I didn't make a solid point against it here, I would be doing my readers and listeners a great disservice. Another funeral, another suicide of a young man. The father looks down at his son's body in the casket. He's at peace now. This was what the mourning friends and family wanted to hear. These words salved the sorrow and made this loss easier to bear. 'No, Dad,' the boy's spirit cried out. 'Stop! Don't tell them that. I watched as his spirit tried desperately to gain his father's attention, and with horror I realized why he was trying so hard to communicate with his dad. His father, naturally, tells everyone that his boy is happier now, freed from his depression and stress. Problem? The young hearers of these words, friends of the suicide, were given thoughts of false hope that they could find peace if they too committed suicide. But their dead friend was trying with all his might to communicate to them that this was not, that he was not at peace. I heard him wail. His fists clenched as he tried to communicate with them and convince them not to believe what his father was saying. My father is wrong, so wrong, he kept saying. Joyce Brown previously cited, pages 59 through 60. When we started this chapter, we mentioned that Lake of Fire and Brimstone was just metaphorical. And yet, in a sense, can we see these suicides in torment? A psychological, spiritual torment that burns within their souls as a lake of fire and brimstone would burn our physical bodies? And let us observe that none of this is arbitrary. God isn't picking names out of a hat and sending some willy-nilly to hell and others by whim to heaven. Nor is the punishment anything that could be considered unfair. The punishment fits the crime. Each one is chained to the consequences of his act. As I have mentioned elsewhere, the cosmos is a nuts and bolts proposition. It all makes sense. It's workable. It's reasonable. And it's real. We have to realize that and try and fit ourselves in as will be of greatest benefit and happiness to our souls. To finish with Joyce Brown, previously cited, page 2, she asks, "What about suicide?" The answer I understood was, if you didn't create it, you can't destroy it. And why can't we end what we think of as our lives? Quote, well, if life is a metaphor for school, consider that if we drop out in, say, March, we cannot, at such time as we figure out we need more education, begin again in March. We have to repeat the entire school year and probably have to take remedial classes. We end up working harder than if we had stuck it out in the first place. End quote. We continue elsewhere in Spirit Prison, back to George Ritchie, previously cited, pages 57 through 67. All of this is recommended reading for those who want a real and frightening picture of the ultimate consequences of evil. I'll paraphrase and skip quote through these pages, making comments as I go. We've already dealt with the control freaks and suicides. Now let's look at the drug and alcohol addicts and others who are obsessively attached to whatever it may be that takes their focus off the true and good things of the cosmos, specifically the centering of their lives on Jesus Christ. Ritchie finds himself with Jesus at his side in a bar near a naval base. Sailors are chugging whiskeys as fast as the bartender can pour them. Quote, then I noticed a striking thing. A number of the men standing at the bar seemed unable to lift their drinks to their lips, hands passing through the solid tumblers, through the heavy wooden countertop, through the very arms and bodies of the drinkers around them. He had earlier observed a similar phenomenon when one mortal woman pulled out and lit a cigarette. A spirit woman standing beside her tried to grab it out of her hands and smoke it, to no avail. One sailor passes out, and a protective cocoon of light that seems part of the mortal beings, but not the spiritual ones, splits open and, quote, one of the insubstantial beings who had been standing near him at the bar was on top of him. Now he seemed to spring at him like a beast of prey. This spirit being disappears into the passed-out body of the sailor, whose protective light vanished with unconsciousness. It happens 3 more times, as Ritchie observed. Presumably, he writes, these substanceless creatures had once had solid bodies, as I myself had had. I suppose that when they had been in these bodies, they had developed a dependence on alcohol that went beyond the physical, that became mental, spiritual, even. Then when they lost that body, except when they could briefly take possession of another one, they would be cut off for all eternity from the thing they could never stop craving. He summarizes, to want most, to burn with most desire where you were most powerless, that would be hell indeed. Well, at least a sobering wake-up call to change one's focus and desires, if one indeed can wake up at that point. He wonders how those spirits waiting at the bar to jump into an unconscious mortal body can miss Jesus standing next to him. It would be like us being in a dark room where a blazing fire suddenly breaks out and not seeing it. Even a blind man would notice the heat and noise. Richie says, maybe whenever our center of attention was on anything else, we could block out even him. From the realm of the addicts, Richie is then taken to a wide plain inhabited only by spirits. At first I thought we were looking at some great battlefield. Everywhere people were locked in what looked like fights to the death, writhing, punching, gouging. No weapons of war, only bare hands and feet and teeth. Oddly, with all the mayhem, no one is hurt. Since all were dead, no one could be killed. They could not kill, though they clearly wanted to. They hurled themselves at each other in a frenzy of impotent rage. If I suspected before that I was seeing hell, now I was sure of it. Up to this moment of the misery I had watched consisted in being chained to a physical world of which we no longer part. Now I saw that there were two other kinds of chains. Here were no solid objects or people to enthrall the soul. These creatures seemed locked into habits of mind and emotion, into hatred, lust, destructive thought patterns. In this same field, along with the fighting, he saw sexual perversions being pantomimed that outdid anything imagined in mortality. But it was all pantomime, all air guitar, as it were. Nothing substantial was accomplished, or could be, with these insubstantial beings. He hears, or at least receives, their thoughts. Quote, the thoughts most frequently communicated had to do with superior knowledge or abilities or background of the thinker. I told you so. I always knew. Didn't I warn you? Were shrieked into the echoing air over and over. But the bottom line, once again, however, no condemnation came from the presence at my side. Only a compassion for these unhappy creatures that was breaking his heart. Clearly it was not his will that any one of them should be in this place. And once again, just because it is not his will that these things go on, and he doesn't do anything overtly about it, doesn't mean he's powerless. He made a commitment with us in the very beginning that he wouldn't fool with our agency, that he'd respect and preserve as sacred our choices. The sanctity of agency overrides all other concerns, and that is by his choice and his power, not his helplessness in these situations. By the way, notice the phrase, that was breaking his heart. If you get into the physiological details of Christ's death on the cross, how the spear was thrust into his side, penetrating his heart, blood mixed with water came out. This is the result of a breaking down of the heart. Christ died for us, and the cause of that death physically was the breaking of his heart. John chapter 19, verses 32 through 34 in the New Testament. I stated earlier that our eternal reward, heaven or hell, call it what you will be to live forever with people who are basically like us. Richie gives a similar view of that scenario. In this plane of hateful, fighting people, every thought is instantly known by every other spirit, probably because they're all alike. They all share the same thoughts. What was keeping them there? Why didn't each one of them just get up and leave? Unless there was no alone in this realm of disembodied spirits, what was it going to be like, I thought with sudden panic, to live forever where my most private thoughts were not private at all? No disguising them, no covering them up, no way to pretend I was anything but what I actually was. How unbearable. Unless, of course, everyone around me had the same kind of thoughts. Unless there was a kind of consolation in finding others as loathsome as oneself, even if all we could do was hurl our venom at each other. truly, misery loves company. Most amazingly of all is that these pathetic spirits, formerly mortals like us, and like people we see on the streets, and even in our families, and sadly perhaps even in our mirrors every day, are not alone on that plane, or in the bar, or other locations Richie visited. He notices angels crowding all of these scenes and places, ready to help and minister to any and all of these spirits. And suddenly I realized that there was a common denominator to all these scenes so far. It was the failure to see Jesus. Whether it was a physical appetite, an earthly concern, or an absorption with self, whatever got in the way of his light created the separation into which we stepped at death. As it says in Matthew 6:22-23, quote, "The light of the body is the eye. If therefore thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of light. But if thine eye be evil, thy whole body shall be full of darkness." End quote. The scriptures, even when they sound most cryptic, have an ultimate applicable nuts and bolts meaning. Back to the eschatological outlook. What we're looking for, what we desire, is what we'll find, be it to our good or detriment. As to the angels hovering over these lost souls ready to minister, Howard Storm's My Descent into Death, previously quoted, observes, page 52-53, quote, "Every person has guardian angels all their lives. Our angels are the embodiment of compassion for us. Because of their reverence for God, they cannot impose themselves on us or intervene in our lives when we choose to reject them and God's love. The more we despise our angels, the more we are on our own. Love attracts more love, and hate attracts hate. A person devoid of the love of God cannot be welcomed into the journey to heaven. They are left on their own. Worse, when those who are turning away from the love of God die, people like them are waiting for them. These kindred spirits are their welcoming committee, which takes them on a journey away from the love and light of God. On this journey, a person embarks on an unending life without God. Hell is separation from God, also known as spiritual death." Again, misery loves company. When Storm first died, he was met by spirits from this realm, previously cited, pages 19-20, leading him slowly until he was in total darkness. They began to torture him. Quote, "They began to push and shove him. A wild frenzy of taunting, screaming, and hitting ensued. They bit and tore back at me. I realized that I was being taken apart and eaten alive, methodically, slowly, so that their entertainment would last as long as possible. They were a mob of beings totally driven by unbridled cruelty." At the lowest point of this episode, Storms is inspired to pray, something that he, as a then atheist, would never have thought of. He does, and his ragged, impromptu prayer actually drives them off. Quote, "Retreating, they became more rabid, cursing and screaming against God. They claimed that what I was praying was worthless, and that I was a coward and nothing. In time, they retreated back into the distant gloom beyond my hearing." His near-death experience moves up from there as he is pulled from this pit by Jesus and healed of the wounds incurred in his fight with these all-too-real demons. These spirits, who either in the premortal encounter existence or later in this earth life, gave their hearts over to follow Lucifer. Swedenborg gives these insights into hell and why some seem attracted to it. Quote, "Happiness is all that everyone in heaven lives for, and all that everyone in hell lives for. The happiness of hell has to do with what is evil and untrue, because all happiness relates to love, and love is the essence of a person's life. Heaven and hell have opposite pleasures because they have opposite loves. Hell has the love of being harmful and the happiness this gives." Page 70. In other words, there are those who truly love causing pain and misery, and from that they achieve what to them is happiness. I would hope that my readers don't find themselves fitting into this description. I know I hope I don't find myself there, but apparently a good percentage of the beings in the cosmos go that route. 1/3 already have. Why? I have no idea. And perhaps they are as flummoxed over our choices of doing good and being useful, kind and loving, as was Christ, as we are flummoxed over their strange choices of an eternity of hatred and darkness. But agency trumps all. If they just stay in their own geographic locations and play out their depredations on each other, fine. But for some reason, their philosophy seems to want to spread as a cancer and must be confined, lest the whole cosmos be ruined into a black hole of, to us, unhappiness. This is where Betty Eady's warring angels come in. In one interesting confrontation between good and evil angels, Swedenborg reports, quote, "The devils said everyone's allowed to enjoy his own happiness, even the most filthy, as they call it, so long as he doesn't bother good spirits and angels. But with our, the devil's, kind of happiness, we can't help bothering them. So we're thrown into penitentiaries where we suffer dreadfully. The suppression and withholding of our pleasures there is what they call the torment of hell," end quote. The good angels ask, "Why do you bother good people?" They said they could not help it. A kind of rage sets in when they see an angel and feel the godly sphere around him. The evil angels are thrown back into hell to keep them from doing any harm, page 37. And here perhaps a connection can be made with Betty Eady's earlier observation of warring angels. This throwing back into hell of intrusive evil beings is perhaps one of their tasks. As an example of the above, when I lived in Oregon in the early 90s, the legislature approved a bill that would let porn phone operate. Okay. If some segment of our society wants to call up a phone number and have someone talk dirty to them, that's their business, right? Well, the porn phone people weren't content to leave it at that. They bought advertising on TV during children's cartoon shows shortly after school and got the kids to dialing up porn phone. As the ads appealed to latchkey kids, as they were called back then, children home alone after school without parental supervision, because both mom and dad were working, the kids would dial up the numbers advertised and listen for several minutes. At the end of the month, mom and dad got a phone bill for several $100. The phone company, of course, was happy to collect the money, so were the porn phone people. This, I feel, is an example of how evil won't stay put in its place, but wants to encroach. If there is one unifying principle, one thing that can be said of all these in these dark realms, it is this, quote, "They are destitute of love. They have ceased to love God. They have ceased to have pure love one towards another. They have ceased to love that which is good. Hatred, malice, revenge, and every evil passion have usurped the place of love, and unhappiness, wretchedness, and misery are the results. Where there is no love, there will be no desire to promote the welfare of others. Instead of desiring that others may be happy, each desires to make all others miserable like himself. Each seeks to gratify that hellish disposition against the Almighty, which arises from his extreme hatred of that which is good. For the want of love, the torment of each is complete. All the wicked who are entirely overcome by these malicious spirits will have the heavenly principle of love wholly eradicated from their minds. They cannot extricate themselves from their demon's power, nor ward off the fiery darts of their malicious tormentors. Such will be the condition of all beings who entirely withdraw themselves from the love of God," end quote. Orson Pratt, The Seer, Volume 1, October 1853. Fyodor Dostoevsky's classic, The Brothers Karamazov, gives a familiar definition of hell, page 322. What is hell? And I answer thus: the suffering of beings no longer able to love. End quote. I've perhaps intermixed hell with spirit prison. I guess, in a nutshell, the difference between spirit prison and hell, as mentioned before, is that spirit prison is a place where Christ can come and minister, meaning there is still hope. Hell is where there is no hope. I can't say for sure if Storm's tormentors were from prison or hell. It would seem to me to be the latter, but I'm not going to go on record. In hell, there is no hope. That's it. Done deal. Many have said, with well-meaning but ignorant hearts, that there is hope even for Satan. I don't think so. There has to be a finality, or nothing has any relevance or impact on our choices and lives. If we believe we can act any which way we please, be tortured for a few millennia in hell, then sail into heaven forever, then where's the motivation for good work, for the development of the soul? I think these realms are real and are eternal, and we need to be aware of their dangers or blessings, and from that awareness we need to make wise choices. These things, I believe, need to be taken seriously. To rise up out of hell, at least that hell which as of yet hasn't become a final and irrevocable place for a damned soul, takes volition, determination on the part of the spirit, just as it does in mortal life. Jordan Peterson, previously cited, a psychiatrist as well as an author, writes, quote, "The desire to improve was, instead, the precondition for progress. I've had court-mandated psychotherapy clients. They did not want my help. They were forced to seek it. It did not work. It was a travesty." Page 81. So in mortal life, so in the spiritual realms. These desires for change have to come from within. They cannot be forced upon any soul and interfere with this agency. Soberly, Storm writes, previously cited, page 53, "There is no love, no light, no hope, no joy, no compassion, no truth, and no peace without God. This is a reality of hate, darkness, despair, suffering, cruelty, lies, and fighting. God will not intervene. And the angels cannot intervene because this has been the individual's choice. God respects our freedom to choose. For some people, this may culminate in the ultimate annihilation of their being. Now, many is the time I've stated we're immortal and eternal spirits, but if we sink this far and so choose to escape the pain, we can be released from immortality. Quote, "The terrible truth is that the deeper people sink into degradation, the less willing they are to seek salvation. Many desire annihilation as relief from the torment of hell. As Christ put it in Luke chapter 23, verse 30, quote, "Then shall they begin to say to the mountains, fall on us, and to the hills, cover us." Hugh Nibley, Nibley on the Timely and the Timeless, previously cited, page 58, gives us in this context, from a number of ancient sources, a description of the recycling of materials in the universe. Nice to know the cosmos recycles. The picture of a constant remixing going on in the universe, in which old, worn-out, contaminated substances, the refuse of worn-out worlds and kingdoms, is first thrown out on the scrap heap and returned to chaos as dead matter, then melted down in a dissolving fire for many years, by which all the impurities are removed from it, and by which it is improved and is ready to be poured from one kind of body into another. This whole process by which souls, note that, this whole process by which souls as well as substances are thrown back into the mixing is under the supervision of Melchizedek, the great reprocessor, purifier, and preparer of worlds. He takes over the refuse of defunct worlds or souls. Note that it is not just the material refuse of stars and solar systems that gets recycled, but souls as well. My take on this would be that those who are irrevocably in hell and completely incapable of coming out of it might choose, as the last vestige of their agency, to be recycled and cease to exist. It would be a mercy to them, but granted to them only upon their express consent. What do they have to live for? Between annihilation and living forever in the darkness and hatred of hell, annihilation might just be the better of their only two choices left. One would think from this that hatred of God is the worst situation we can be in. It's not so easy. Storm observed, previously cited, page 52, quote, "If a person is not ruled by the love of God, he or she is ruled by hatred of God. The greatest hatred of God is to be indifferent to God. We were created and put in this world to know God's will and to live accordingly. To disregard this is contempt for the God of the universe. A person who is indifferent to God is repelled by his light and love. There is no middle ground. If you think you're nonpartisan on these issues, that you'll be comfortable sitting on the fence, you'll find yourself being included with those that openly hate God. As Joshua put it, quote, "And if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you will serve. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." End quote. Old Testament, Joshua 24:15. And we note again the operating principle of agency. We've seen heaven and God, hell and Lucifer. Now let's take a look at us. What makes us human? What do we have to work with and on? And thus we conclude this 13th podcast of the series, Becoming Human in the Cosmos, based on the book I have on Amazon. The next podcast will be titled Chapter 7, Part 1, and we'll deal with what makes us human. Join me, please, and thanks for tuning in, and special thanks to Craig and Kate Whitmore, my technical personnel, without whom this podcast and my website wouldn't even exist in the cloud as dust particles. Visit our website at hazelleproductions.com. That's HAZELLEPRODUCTIONS.com. Thank you.